Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Hello, I'm Joss Stone. Thanks for joining me for A Cuppa Happy. I spent the last few years singing my songs in every country in the world and been lucky enough to meet incredible people from all walks of life. What really struck me is that no matter where we are, we're all on the same mission. We're all just trying to find our version of happy. So with this podcast, I'm going to be speaking to a whole host of people to dig deeper into the what, why, and how of this emotion we call happiness. I hope that with these conversations, you discover something to help you on your own quest for happiness, possibly change your mind on a few things, and along the way, share a good old laugh with me and my guests. Today's guest is an executive and personal coach who during her long career has spent over 18,000 hours on the phone working with people to improve their lives. She's worked with all sorts of people, including CEOs at huge companies like American Express and the BBC. Coaching is a new and intriguing idea to me, similar in some ways to therapy, but also very different. It focuses on the present and the future, rather than looking back, actively taking control of your life and working out what you want and taking the steps to get there. Find out how during today's chat with the incredible Katie Harvey. Hi, Katie.
Hello, Joss.
How are you?
Really well, thank you. I've been really excited about this podcast. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, good. Oh, it's so lovely to talk to you. It's lovely to see your face so I can see your massive smile.
Yeah, it is quite massive with huge teeth.
You're already making me feel happier. So well done. Job done.
Exactly. The teeth, they work in some ways.
Totally.
The thing that's difficult about Squadcast and Zoom and all of these is that I know that in order to look in your eyes, I have to look at that funny little hole at the top. But I really want to look at you and look at your face, and that's down there. And so just forgive me if I'm looking in the wrong place.
Eye contact, very important, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I noticed that I met a few Scientologists in my lifetime, not many, but they don't half stare at you. Have you met any Scientologists?
Yeah. Do you know, it's funny you should say that, Joss. I've been fascinated by Scientology for a long time, but never met
one. Have you?
Yeah,
oh,
I really have. I've been very interested. I guess I'm just fascinated by humankind and all its idiosyncrasies. And Scientology seems to me one of its idiosyncrasies. So I've been interested, but no, I haven't.
So I have learned that you're also a musician. Is that right?
Well, what's really funny, Joss, is I'm just off the back of a long camping weekend where I sang around the campfire for three nights, so my voice has dropped about an octave.
Do you know what? I was going to ask you exactly that. I was going to say, are you around the campfire type of girl or a classical musician? So I have my answer.
Well, in a way, I'm both, I guess, because my background was in classical, because all my family are classical musicians. And so that's what they do. And that's what I did. But I was the one of the family who never went on to perform and went into psychology instead. But so now what I do is I sing to my children at nighttime and I sing around a campfire a couple of times a year. And that makes me very happy.
Oh, that's lovely. Oh, do you know what? I spent a little bit of time in a forest in France and it was kind of mad because the people that were there, half of them lived there in the forest all the time. And they were just the most beautiful, balanced, like very accepting type of people.
Yeah, I bet.
There's something really special in that, in being in nature and music. It kind of gives you
exactly
a bit of joy.
That's exactly what my last 3 days have been. They've been a perfect intro to this podcast on happiness because
three days
in a forest, that's where we were in a woodland, and singing around a campfire. Yeah,
that was
definitely happy.
Oh, I need to be doing that. So I heard that you do happiness nights.
Ah, yes. So there's a very, very famous book. As a coach, my job, and it's a very lovely part of my job, is to read an enormous amount of books about happiness and life and people. And I'd read them for pleasure, but I love that I can pretend it's work too. Yeah. So one of the most famous books on happiness is called The Happiness Project by Gretchen Rubin. And I read that, feels like 8 years ago now. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine read it too. And what she does is Gretchen thinks about happiness. She was just kind of going through her life, going through the motions and thinking, I should be happier. I've got everything. I'm hugely privileged. Why am I not happier? And so she decided to do a project, take a year to look at happiness and to see whether she could tweak aspects of her life and whether that would create happiness. So she took January for home decluttering or something, and then she took meditation for February, and she went on through the year taking a different topic for every month, just with the aim of seeing how much impact it had on her happiness. And so my friend and I read this book, thought it was really interesting, and decided to create a group of our own with our friends, and we would meet up on the last Friday of every month and think about one particular aspect of life, just as she'd done, come together to talk about it, set intentions for the coming month, and then all discuss it in the next one. And some people definitely were more engaged with it than others. Some people just turned up for the wine, other people for the food. And I was obviously doing it religiously for a year, and it made a massive difference to my life. We've since carried it on. We're into our seventh year, I think, now.
Oh my goodness.
Meeting up, we're an amazing group of friends, but now it really is just about the food and the laughter and the wine.
Oh, that's lovely. So when you sit down and have these chats, is it kind of like Thanksgiving situation where you say, I am grateful for, or do you really like get into, you know, the concept of relationships or whatever it is that month? How did it work so people can recreate that?
Well, I think we made up this idea ourselves, but actually at the same time, we didn't realize that Gretchen Rubin on her website, which I don't know what it is, but I think she herself has put out this idea to people who want to create groups and meet up about it. But so what we did was we would pick a different theme for each month, and we'd start off. I seem to remember I might have spoken a bit about what I discovered from clients on that particular theme, and then everyone would go around the table and talk about what they were going to do, set goals really, and set intentions for the coming month on that topic,
to work on it,
and then we'd review and reflect on the last months and what everybody did and whether it had increased the happiness. Or
it sounds very proactive. It sounds really good. Yeah, I mean, why not take the bull by the horns and go, actually, let's focus in on this issue that we have, because we all have the same issues really.
Well, that's it. There's such a lot of commonality. And I'd like to point out there is and was a lot more silliness than I'm making it sound. There's an awful lot more laughter to it too.
But that's good. That's what we need.
That is what we need, because it was all about happiness. But it did, it led itself to some huge changes in my life when I think back over that year.
Sometimes good just to be conscious. You know what? I'm known, it's quite funny. Some people think I'm the most patient person in the world. And some people think I'm the most impatient person in the world. Depends how you kind of are in my life. So if you're my engineer and I'm working on a record, they probably think I'm a bit impatient. But my boyfriend, for some reason, thinks I'm super patient. So
that's probably the right way around to have it.
Yeah, that's nice. But I was in the studio a few years ago, and I noticed that the chap that I was working with, he was very... just really chill and slow. And, you know, the way I work is very playful. It's like, okay, guys, this is what we're doing. This is the song. These are the chords. 1, 2, 3. Let's go in and we'll just do it. And
I can imagine that.
Oh, God, it can be fun. But to somebody that takes longer and wants a little bit more time and patience and, you know, calm, that can be very annoying. So I realize how annoying I was being to this poor guy. So I went to my friend Harriet. She makes, and you tell me what you think about this, she makes flower remedies for you. So she said, Jossie, you need patience. So she found this flower that was specific for patience, and she made me a little bottle. Aww. And she said, what I want you to do is just put it under your tongue, like, actually, it was 8 times a day, which is kind of a lot. And she said, just think of the word patience. Don't think about whether you have it in abundance or whether you don't. Don't think about any of that. Just the word being part of your day will do something good. And oh my God, it changed the sessions.
Did it?
totally, yeah.
Oh, good.
I took about 3 days and then I was like, I noticed, I was like, oh, this is flowing so much better. And I don't know whether that's a placebo or I don't know what that is.
I think we'd probably talk about that being two things, I would imagine, kind of intention setting, because we talk a lot in coaching and in personal development around setting intentions, which really also is about mindfulness, isn't it? Mm. It's about choosing. I know you, I've listened to your other lovely podcasts, and I know you talk a lot about having choice, and it's a really big thing in coaching, is having, always having that feeling of choice, which is a complicated topic, but still. So choosing patience or is about exercising that choice and setting an intention, but then saying it that many times a day helps you be more mindful in the moment, I would imagine. So I think it would be those two things that would be working for you there.
Right. Yeah. I've noticed how choice has somehow, I don't know what happened, but it became controversial.
I read that.
Isn't it amazing? Like, I mean, it's amazing and interesting, and it's kind of shocking and a little bit confusing to me, but also you can understand why. Mm. So in your opinion, you know, you've spoken to many different people over years and years and years. So you've got a lot of experience with different personality types and trying to help them.
Yeah, I do.
So do you think, after everything that you know, that everybody has the opportunity to make their lives better? Or do you think there's some people that just don't? They just never will. They will never be happy, or they'll never have choice. Or do you think that that is a thing, that that exists?
Well, I think that it's a complicated one, because I think there are certainly things that we have choice over and things that we don't have choice over. There was an incredible guy called Viktor Frankl. He was a prisoner, I think, in a Nazi concentration camp. And he wrote a book called Mind and Meaning, or I'm probably saying the name of the book wrong. But my understanding of his quote and what he said during that book is that they can take away all of our freedoms, but they don't have control over our minds. And we ultimately have a choice as to how we think and how we react to things that are happening to us. And so I understand the idea of saying that everyone has choice sounds rather glib and sounds kind of privileged. And yet I also understand the idea that, yeah, we always have choice over how we respond to something or how we react to something and over what we choose to think in a situation. So I come back to that kind of Viktor Frankl. If he said it and he was in the toughest of times, you know, then I get that. But having said that, learning how to use that choice over what we think and feel and how we respond to something, that takes a lot of work. Most of us on automatic pilot the whole time through our lives, I think. I certainly include myself in that. I try not to be, but I'm still on automatic pilot a lot.
Yeah.
So I'm not actually exercising that choice very frequently. Mm. But coaching, my job and through my job, coaching helps people take the time to learn how to use their choice, to learn how to think, to learn how to be mindful, to learn how to make the choices in their life that will make their lives as happy as they want them to be. So yeah, it's that I love my job helping other people to exercise that choice. And then as a side effect, allows me that choice too, I think.
Mm. So if you're faced with somebody that truly doesn't believe that they have that choice to exercise, how would you combat that? How would you help them kind of gain that belief? I mean, it's kind of it's like faith, I guess. You know, if you believe in God, you believe in God. Doesn't matter how many, how much science is put in front of you, how much data is put in front of you saying the opposite. That's what you believe.
Yeah.
And that's essentially blind faith. That can be good for you or bad for you.
That's right.
But I've noticed that within this particular conversation, if someone doesn't think that it's there, then how can they use it? Mm.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
people tend to come to coaching because they want to make some kind of positive change in their life.
So they already think that it's there.
There must be some hope. There must be some idea that there could be a change. So that's the first thing to say, is that they'll come because
they're not forced into it, are they? They do go on their own, right?
They, in my practice particularly, people come, they choose to come and have coaching. There are some corporations where they, a person is given a coach, but in my practice, people come and choose to work with me. Having said that, though, clients often have limiting beliefs about themselves and about what's possible for them in various ways. So although they've got kind of a macro sense of hope, the micro about certain things might be quite limiting. So there are many techniques of working with limiting beliefs, but the first, I think, is understanding it, to understand where it's come from, to understand where it's serving you, because that might sound a bit counterintuitive, but sometimes holding a limiting belief can serve us in some ways, keep us feeling safe or
protect
in our comfort zone and protect us, exactly. So there's a kind of first step of really understanding that limiting belief. I call it excavating around it, like where it's come from. And then you become, you do the work, which can take time and you do need to be patient often.
Yeah.
But there's that thing around, okay, what would you like your new belief to be? And how do we build up evidence? How do we test out whether that new belief could be true? And so often we'll set homework for the client to take during the week in between we speak to each other, and then they'll come back and report back in, and bit by bit by bit they grow the evidence of, okay, yeah, this new belief could be true, and then over time it becomes true and it replaces the limiting one.
Wow. Okay, I'm going to take that on and do my best. You know, I wanted to ask you, because you coach coaches. So I feel like every time I'm asking you a question, I'm feeling like, okay, this could help me help that person, or, you know, everything that you really said to anybody, I think, in your life, including in your sessions, you're not just helping that one person, you're helping whoever is next to that person too.
That's one of my favorite bits about it, is that,
isn't that lovely?
You know that the knock-on effect,
it's
huge.
Truly happening, you know.
Yeah.
My brother went to a therapist and would come home and tell me what he learned, and that helped me. And I do the same. And it's like, oh my God, we're learning all this stuff that helps us, you know, helps us help other people. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous way to use your time on the planet. So a lot of people turn into the therapist for their friends, because not everybody has, I suppose, the time or the money to hire a therapist.
That's right.
So they'll go to their mum or their best mate and get advice, I suppose, and vent. But sometimes those people are really great and helpful, and sometimes they are really not.
That's
they
right.
are super toxic and awful. And they'd be like, nah, just go round in, I don't know, Kia's car. You know, like, they could go so wrong, right?
It could.
So what would you say, you know, to somebody that isn't a therapist but wants to help their friend? How do we do it without wrecking their lives?
Well, okay, so coaching is non-directive. That's what it's termed as. So, and what non-directive means, and it's probably obvious, but is that we don't tell people what to do. So for years and years, because I've been going for 18 years, and I've been trained out of ever telling someone to go and key a car or go and leave their partner or get a new job or hand in the notice.
It must be so hard. Well, I guess for you, it's not anymore. But
not anymore. But at the beginning, it was certainly really hard. And it is one of the things actually that new coaches most grapple with, is turning off that desire to say, oh, dump him, or oh, go after that job,
leave
or go
him.
For the promotion. Exactly. At the beginning, it's hard. But after so many years, what I now find really hard is if a friend ever does come to me and say, what do you think I should do? I almost can't. What I do, and this is the advice I would give, is to say, ask questions. Just hold a space for the person to think in and listen really well, and then ask questions. And what you'll find is the person will come to their own answer for themselves. And it's usually a much better one than you might have given yourself to them. So that's what I would say to people wanting to help their friends, is listen and ask questions rather than jump to that tell.
Yeah. You
know, but I'm sure there's a balance, because sometimes it must be good to tell. And I think my friends probably find it frustrating that I never
probably.
Do.
They probably know that you kind of know. Because you're so well versed in it. And they're like, can you just tell me? I can't figure this out. Please just tell me. But you know what? If you're told to do something, like you say, you kind of, it doesn't go in the same way than if you learn it yourself or kind of stumble across it yourself. Then you feel like you've kind of, You've done something, you've achieved something, I suppose.
I don't think it's as sustainable, and I don't think it's as empowering as figuring it out for yourself. I'm all about the person figuring out their way forward and what works for them, and then not wanting or needing the coaching anymore, as it were, and feeling that they've got that inside them. I have clients call me years later, or maybe drop in for a session years later, and say, now you think you haven't spoken to me for ages, but I speak to you all the time. You're inside my head, or you're just on my shoulder. And I think to myself, what would Katie ask me right now? Yeah. And what I love is they never say, what would Katie tell me to do right now? They always say, what would she ask me?
What
would she
great.
Say about this? And so they're not really, of course, using me. They're just kind of using me personified as their own wisdom inside. And I love that that gets internalized, and then they don't need me anymore. You know,
you've helped them question themselves.
Yeah.
Which is the most important thing that all of us should be doing.
We all need an internal coach, I think. Sometimes we need an external one too, to help us build the internal coach. But yeah, that internal voice inside that asks us the questions, that gives us support along the way, holds us accountable. We all need to develop that.
Do you need one?
So I'll have different coaches for different times. When I had children, I picked a particular type of coach when I was coming out of that maternity and back into coaching again. And then when I kind of growing the practice even more or ramping up in some particular way, I'll have a different one. But absolutely,
oh, really?
I do. Yeah. Oh, without a doubt. I don't think I could believe in coaching as a useful tool in people's lives as much as I do if I didn't then think it would be useful for me as well.
How do you find them? How do you kind of select somebody that works for you in that sphere?
I think it's important to speak. I'll speak for people in general as well as myself, but I think it's important to speak to a few coaches. I also think it's great, just as with lots of services, I guess, to have a referral, a recommendation from a friend. If you have someone that you know who knows you and has worked with that coach and thinks that you'd be a great fit, then brilliant. But if you haven't ever come across someone who's worked with a coach, because it's still relatively new, then you might find a coach through the internet maybe and speak to a few. But I think what's so important is that you feel a fit, you feel the chemistry between you, that you can laugh together, that you feel a sense of trust and a sense of safety with that person. And I think that's vital, because when I remember there was a study done many years ago about the efficacy, the power of coaching versus therapy versus counseling versus all the different interventions.
Yeah, what's the difference? I hear you say coach a lot, but not therapist, and it's kind of sounds like the same thing.
Ah, well, I'll talk to that, but I'll just finish the thing that with all of those different things, I remember that one of the major predictors of success was not actually which one you chose, but was about the relationship between you and your coach or you and your therapist. And if that's strong and healthy, then the outcome will be successful almost regardless of which way you went. But I will tell you about the different ways. Thank you asking.
Yeah.
So I'm going to make this too simplistic, Joss, and probably have therapists and counsellors up in arms and coaches up in arms.
Sometimes we just have to be simple about things. Yeah,
exactly. And I love simplicity. So it's said to be that therapy looks into the past and heals the past and figures out why something is the way it is through understanding the emotional past to then move into the present to feel well in the present. Coaching tends to take the present and the future as its focus. So it tends to start by asking, how would you like something to be? And that could be in your professional life, it could be in your personal life, but it's very much looking into that future and then ascertaining where we are right now. So you've got point A here right now and then point B off in the future, this desired place that you want to be. And then it's about closing the gap between the two. So yeah, they tend to have these different focuses. It's not exclusively so. Simplistically, that's the difference.
Are the studies different leading up to it, the education?
Yeah, the training. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, very different. There's huge transferable skills around listening and questioning and empathy and rapport and all of those good things. But yeah, there really are differences about because of this focus on moving to the future and goal setting, I guess, and setting intentions. That is really different to working with somebody in the emotional past and working with trauma or working with addiction. In therapy, of course, there are very specific areas of understanding too, whereas coaching tends to be more, again, because we're non-directive and we're not giving advice. You can apply coaching in any different topic, whether that be working with a CEO of a company or someone starting their own business or working with relationship issues, you can still apply coaching. Whereas in therapy, you may have someone coming with an addiction or bereavement or mental illness, and you'll be trained in those specific areas. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. It must be a very positive way to live. I mean, if you're constantly having conversations encouraging people towards optimism and tomorrow, yeah. it's got to fill up your life with brightness.
I just feel so lucky just to have my job. It does. No, it really, really does. And it probably sounds twee that I'm not telling the truth, but it just really does fill up my day with positivity and laughter and hope,
yeah.
because people are coming talking about where they'd like to be. It's not to say that everyone's journey is smooth and always straight up and there's lots of bumps along the way,
yeah,
but it is a very, very positive, happy job. I feel really lucky to have it, and it rubs off into my life too. I know it does.
When the hope's gone, then it's just too difficult. It's too sad for hope to go. It's just awful. So if that's your world and you're giving people hope, wow, how lovely. Congratulations.
I feel I'll take that congratulations, because I do feel really lucky I found it when I did. If I was born a little bit earlier, let's say, or I might not have found it, because it just was coming to the UK where I'm based at exactly the time when I was searching for what I wanted to do in my life. And I read an article about coaching, this newfangled thing that had come over from the States. And I just thought, that's it. This is the thing that I was born to do.
Right. If it's American, I didn't know it was, but it totally makes sense that it was. You know, we as English people, we do often make jokes about the Americans being too positive and too optimistic. And it's like, God, can't believe him. He said, have a nice day. What a wanker. It's like, how can you say
we're so naughty to do that? We are.
Yeah, it's so naughty. It really is. But of course, that affects the general happiness of the nation. So yeah. Surely it does affect it. But so you're working in England, right?
Coaching's always been, for me, and actually across most of the profession, very, very virtual. So prior to, so when kind of COVID and lockdown happened, it was business as usual for me, because ever since 18 years ago when I started, I've been working on audio, not through Zoom, that didn't exist back then, but I would be working on just on the telephone line. So I've always worked around the world with a person in New Zealand one minute, and then someone in New York, and then someone here and someone there. And it's always been that way.
Okay, so I read that you have worked with people in like huge companies. I knew that. I just have a little list that Rich made for me. People within the BBC, Hearst Pierpoint College, Hiscox, Disney, Christian Aid, American Express, EE, Vodafone, and BT. Woof! I mean, that's just some. I know that's just some. And I know there's many, many more, but that just gives the listeners an idea of what type of people that you work with. Now,
I love how varied it is.
Isn't that great?
It is that varied.
And they're all like, they're all companies that we have heard of. I don't know whether you're working with the CEOs or what, I don't know.
All across the range, actually. And I've purposefully been that way.
Okay, that's
that
good.
I'll be working 1 minute with a CEO, and then another minute with someone who's very new to their early career and just starting out, and then another with a mum returning to work, and then another minute with somebody who has been unemployed for a long time. And it's that variety that I think has kept me, one of the things that's kept me as in love with it as I have been over these years, because I never did want to niche in one particular level of an organization or even in organizations. I love working in them, out of them, at this level, at that level, and with lots of different topics along the way.
Yeah.
A lot of the clients I work with are people that can afford to fund coaching. So that does then mean that there's a bias.
Oh, I see.
But I do, okay. I do a fair bit of pro bono work to make sure that I'm also offering coaching out to places where they wouldn't necessarily afford it otherwise.
Oh, okay. So how do you make your decisions on who you work for pro bono?
Oh, what a good question, Jess.
I want to know about your heart.
it's relatively selfish in a way. Assuming that somebody wouldn't be able to fund the coaching for themselves, then if I think I'd do really good job working with them because I'd really love to, then I say yes to it, assuming I've got the time to do it properly. I always think that if I am as engaged as possible, i.e. I love the client, I love what they're doing, then I'm going to be the best coach that I could be in that moment. So I kind of do it on what I'd really love to do. Like, I really love working with teachers, and I do quite a lot of voluntary work here in the UK with teachers. And so I and maybe because since having children, I've understood more about the role education plays, of course, it's obvious to say, but that's really something that I feel very passionately about. So I love giving time to teachers, and because I'm that engaged in it and passionate about it, it just means I do a better job, I think.
So you're empowering people. Yeah. A friend of mine, she is a great teacher. She works with lovely children that have learning disabilities. Yeah. My God, she's so great with the kids. But sometimes with the school or the rules or the teachers or the Ofsted officers or the, you know, the people that come in that aren't the kids are not the problem. The kids are wonderful. Yeah. She's got amazing methods. They love the bones of her. It's actually the environment yeah. and, you know, the fact that maybe the schools are underfunded, you know, absolutely. In comparison to other schools in the UK, not the world. But that stresses her out.
Yeah.
Like so much. You know, and there's nothing that I feel like I can say apart from just encourage yeah. her to keep doing what she's doing. How do you kind of help somebody in a scenario where they genuinely do feel helpless? Like there's nothing they can do apart from quit. What would you ask? What would be the question, not the instruction?
Well done.
I'm getting there. I'm getting there.
There's a coach in the making there, Jess.
What would you ask her?
I think I'd start by asking her what she wants.
Well, she would say, I want the head of the school to not be such a dick.
I love how we're role playing a coaching session with your friend and me right now.
She's going to listen to this and be like, that's not what I would say, Joss.
And also, I can't believe that you've just said that with my boss. Yeah. Just make sure you don't say her name and then we're all good.
oh, my God. Yeah, so that's it. She's like, I just want my boss to just not be a dick.
What we do is I'd ask her what she can control and what she can't control. And we'd explore all the areas of which she's got influence and where she can control. It could be that she just realizes she's just got to leave and she's got to go somewhere else. Or it could be that she realizes she could influence the boss. Or it could be that she could learn to tone down her irritation, maybe. I don't know. But all of those are options, I guess. And those are things that are within her control. So we'd explore all of that and then look at what's outside of her control and what we can do about that, whether there's any kind of acceptance that could be had or, you know, if she really does just need to make a change. And then once that's all explored, what's within her control, then we'd start to look at choosing a plan for moving forward and what that would look like, breaking it down into little steps and then kind of setting off down that path of taking the action. See?
It's letting go, isn't it, of things that you can't change. You can't change other people. You can only change yourself.
You do have to sit down and take a good look of what you do need to let go because you can't change it and what you can change. In any challenging area in our life, we have to have the space to do that bit first before we can then make the choices to what we do let go or what we don't when we move on.
Yep. Okay, so I have a question about those people that you have coached that are very high up in a company, say in a position of massive power. Mm-hmm. Over a lot of people, I suppose. I think a lot of people believe that, well, first of all, they can't have any problems because they got money.
Yes.
And also, I think that, especially politicians, actually, because they get a lot of shit, and people that run massive companies, I've had many conversations about how evil. In your opinion, are people sat there, that the people in a position of massive power, mm-hmm. are they sat there kind of rubbing their hands together after the day going, I am so glad that I have taken all this money from the world and I don't care that these people can't drink or eat. Do they lose empathy? I guess the question is
around empathy. I just read an amazing book called Humankind. I think the guy is called Rutger Berman. Sorry if I'm pronouncing that wrong. But he talked, it was such a good book, and he talked about the fact that as humans, our natural default setting is towards empathy and kindness. He said that it is nice. That's why I loved the book. He said that we've been fed for a long, long time the idea that left to our own devices, we'd all go feral. Lord of the Flies situation, that bottom line, we're all kind of just greedy, power thirsty, money grabbing, that civilization has kind of civilized us. But he said that that is a line we've been fed and that actually the research and the thinking these days shows that fundamentally we are by default pointed towards kindness and empathy. And that is a belief I like to hold about people and certainly helps me in my job to do that and just means that I have a happier life on the planet if I'm believing that to be true. But I've seen it to be true as well. Having said that, I know that there are people, of course, who are wired differently or who have extreme trauma in their childhood. And through that, their empathy can be completely switched off. Maybe it wasn't even ever turned on through childhood, or maybe it's very, I think, as far as I understand, it's very rare to not be be able to use or have empathy at all if you're wired that way. But I think that does exist sometimes. But I think mostly it is that you were never taught as a child to have empathy. But okay. I do think that is pretty rare, and that actually we're hardwired for kindness and connection and empathy.
Have you come across any of those, the rare ones?
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's a spectrum, isn't it? More than anything, it's a spectrum. And definitely in my work over the years with hundreds and hundreds of people, on that spectrum, there have been people that are just so full of empathy for others that I'm just in awe of them. And actually, it can be quite tricky for them to live their lives. They get tripped up by the empathy a lot. So I've worked with people on that scale, and I've certainly worked with other people that are further down the other side of the scale for whom empathy is just not a huge part of their profile, and maybe they weren't trained in it as much as children, or it just isn't the way their brain is wired so much. But I mean, they're not out there kind of, as you say, gloating or rubbing their hands together necessarily, but empathy isn't their dominant feature. There's a fantastic, well, I believe it's fantastic, personality profiling tool called Myers-Briggs. Don't know if you've ever come across it, or MBTI, and it kind of tells you different personality types. And I've found that really instructive over the years to understand that, we're all wired as personalities quite differently, even though there do tend to be groupings of them. And some, about half it looks like, and it is more dominated towards women, do have more of a leaning towards empathy, and another half, and there is a gender bias again in that, men tend not to have such a leaning towards empathy. But still, as I say, it's a huge spectrum. And I think I'm lucky not to have worked with anyone on the far end of the spectrum.
Definitely. There's something that happened when you were young that made you give a shit about people. You know, how was your childhood? What about your mum and dad? And
what a question, Jess. How was your childhood, Kate? I always, from being, I think, two, the earliest games that I used to play were always about feeding the teddies and rescuing the teddies and looking after them. So I think, just as maybe you were banging a drum or singing as a two-year-old, I guess, I was always doing that nurturing stuff from a really young age, and it was patently obvious. I think you're lucky if it is obvious from a young age, because you then have a clue as to what to do as you go through life. But it really was very obvious for me, and I'm very fortunate that it wasn't necessarily any kind of bad experience. It was more that I was wired, I think, to want to nurture. How about you though, Joss? Did you always know that you wanted to be
I actually wanted to be a vet. So
did you?
Yeah, I did. I always wanted to be a vet.
Yeah,
but really my thing is not, I kind of went into wanting to be a singer as I got older. And when I say older, I mean 5 or 6 opposed to 2. So
ancient.
Yeah, right. And I think it's because when you're little, you kind of, you do things, don't you? And then you see who smiles and who doesn't. And it's the reaction that we have from those around us. And they'd be like, go on, Jossie, do that again. So I'd sing along to that, and that will make people happy.
And a star was born.
Yeah, kind of. I don't know. But I think my focus is really about happy giving. So if you can give someone comfort with a song or a feeling, you should probably do it if you can. And it's kind of like if you can help somebody in their emotions, like what you're doing, if you can help someone feel more confident, more empowered, feel like they have choice. Wow. If you can, well, you should probably do it.
Yes, I love that. One of the things that I love most about the career coaching part of what I do is that it is doing what you're saying. It's helping people figure out where their leaning is towards, where their profile fits. Mm. Mine was always nurturing. Yours was around making people happy through performance, and animals too, from the sounds of it. But, and other people's is because they're a whiz with numbers, or they're absolutely fantastic, green-fingered with gardening, and other people amazing at creating set design, you know. And so what I love about that part of my job is that I help people figure out what they were not quite born to do, because I don't believe for everyone there is just one thing or something, but to help them figure out what their profile lends itself to and where their strengths are best served, and then that they can go down that route, as you say, because you if you've got that, then you probably ought to do it, you know.
Yeah. It's the why, isn't it?
Yeah. And we need it, and we need a meaning and purpose. We all do. We know that that's a key element of happiness, is having a life filled with that purpose and meaning, and in particular, because we spend so much of our time in our working lives, to make sure that we have that purpose and meaning, and that certainly brings happiness.
And essentially health, happiness, and to be calm or to feel contented or to laugh and giggle. It's been proven time and time and time and time again that it does affect your physical health.
That's right.
Have you seen people's physical health affecting their mental at all?
Absolutely, without a shadow of a doubt. I think in order for coaching to be as successful as possible, then people need to be creating the right environment almost for it to be possible. And so one of the things we can look at, and often do look at, is the aspects of their physical environment, like how much sleep they're getting, or how much their nutrition. And it, again, it's not that I'm an expert in any of those things. I'm helping them to think about and consider their how much movement they've got in their life, how much rest they've got in their life, for example. And yes, when they are taking care of themselves better, when their health in that way is good, when they've got good, adequate sleep, then certainly their mood improves, and their resourcefulness improves, and their creativity improves for sure. And they need all of those things to continue through the coaching process. So health is something we look at often quite early on, just to make sure that they're maximizing it in every way they can to help the coaching process.
Yeah. I heard that you had, you and your hubby had coronavirus.
Oh, yes.
Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm so sorry.
Just at the beginning.
I just read it. I didn't know whether that was some rumor or something. I'm so sorry. How was it? What was your experience with it?
It was pretty horrid, actually. But, you know, we're through it and feel really lucky to be. But it was right at the beginning of lockdown in the UK. So that was
it was probably at the scariest time for it to happen.
Yeah. And actually, in my case, that was part of the challenge for me, is not so much the physical side of it, although it wasn't pleasant, but it was just a kind of a bug, I guess. But it was the psychological side that was really hard, is that, as you say, it was scary. We didn't know what it was. Mm. For my husband, it was more severe physically. He was very poorly and nearly needed hospitalization, but in the end he was okay and he pulled through. But the psychology, that side of it, was quite scary and quite,
it's awful.
Yeah, it was definitely very anxiety provoking.
Would you have any advice for anyone else that has it right now that might be listening?
Yeah, I would, but for what it's worth, because, you know, it was only my experience of it. But I certainly would turn off any news. That might sound really strange because it's not a doctor's advice, but it is a kind of person in psychology. Turn off the news. That was a mistake I made, because it was also new and I wanted to understand it and do the best for myself. I was reading constantly about what happens on day 7, what happens on day 8, what are the long-term prognoses for people that have had it, and I was just terrifying myself with all of that information,
which
wasn't
sicker.
Real. Which certainly made me sicker, without a doubt. Of course, I'm not saying to be irresponsible and not find out, but choose a medical healthcare professional that you trust and speak to them about it, but don't go asking everyone for anecdotes about people they've known or reading things, you know, about this time when that person got reinfected or something. It's just very, very frightening. And the media are not helping in that way, I believe, because as we know, the media can need to sell stories. And so they often peddle in fear, and this is not the time to be peddling in fear. So yeah, I would, my number one advice would be to switch off from that and trust that you'll get through, you know.
Yeah, listen to your body. You know when you're feeling sick, right? We don't often, when we get the flu, we don't turn on the news.
Yeah, we just speak to someone that we trust about it. We do what we need to do, listen to our bodies, etc. And yeah, so that would be the one thing I could say, really.
I do think the fear that comes with this virus is so, it's just overtaking, isn't it? I spoke to my dad on the first, I suppose, when you had the virus, right at the beginning of the lockdowns. And he had it, but he didn't know he had it.
Oh, goodness.
But
is he well now?
He's fine now, yeah. He's had the test, he's got the antibodies. So that's how we know that that's what it was. But he just had a really terrible, what we thought was flu. And it was horrible talking to him, because, I mean, it was lovely to talk to him, don't get me wrong. It was horrible, the conversation we were having, because it was like I was stuck in America. Luckily, I was with my mum, thank God. Mm. We all felt like the world was going to implode and we were never going to see our loved ones again. And my dad had a conversation with me that I will never forget. It was like, Jossie, I just want you to know that if anything happens, I want you to know that I've had a really good life.
Oh.
You know, these type of words were coming out of his mouth. Mm. Oh, makes me feel sad talking about it right now. But but it was just, the conversation was the horrible bit. It was the fear. It wasn't the virus that was the horrible bit, actually.
That's right. That's
you exactly know, I right. didn't have the virus, but it made me sick in other ways, you know. So
I've heard people talking about the pandemic of anxiety that has been growing through this. And in my practice with my clients, I've seen so much more anxiety than I've ever seen in the 18
Have
years
you?
Prior to it. Absolutely. And so much more reflection, and so many people wanting to make huge changes in their life because of that, which is not, of course, a bad
that's
thing.
Good. But that's positive.
That's very good. That's an upside, I think. But certainly an awful lot more anxiety than I've ever seen before.
Yeah. We have to try and be positive now, I think. I think we've had enough. I think we've had enough of this negativity now. Enough.
And use our choice that you talked about before.
Do this. Yeah. Let's use our controversial choice.
Yes,
and try
exactly.
to be positive, you know. Try. We have to try at least. That's the most important thing. And there's good things that are happening in the news, you know. It's just hard to find it because there's always like a little slant on it that makes it negative, because people react much more passionately to a negative piece of news than they do to a positive. So they're going to give us more negative because that's their job, is to get ratings
up.
Yeah.
There's some really good news channels where you just do search for just good news and you can filter the news via that. I subscribe to some of those and they're lovely.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, it's great. It's good to know that there's such an awful lot of great going on in the world, as you say, but you just don't get to hear about it if you don't seek it, basically.
Yep. It's not as entertaining, basically. Mm. Okay, so if you could say one thing to all of the listeners, if they could make one action to improve their lives when they, you know, put down their headphones from listening to this podcast, what could it be? And it's hard to choose one because you have so many things. And also the advice thing, I know you're not supposed to give, but
true. This is my one opportunity, Justin, the whole of my life, to give some advice to somebody. It's here, it's now, I better get this right. I suppose I do have something that springs to mind. I'll probably afterwards finish this and think, oh, there's this and this and this and this. But I think what underpins most of coaching is one's relationship with oneself and how well a person knows themselves, and then how much a person likes oneself, self-esteem, as we'd say. Mm-hmm. And whatever people are working with me on in coaching, whether it is their career or whether it is starting a business or their massive company, whatever it is, the relationship with themselves is kind of central to it all. And will their self-knowledge and self-esteem will improve as the coaching goes on through that focus, really. So I think my one piece of advice would be to spend time getting to know yourself, which sounds very hippie, I know, or twee, but I guess you can do that in so many different ways. You can do that through working with a coach, you can do it working with a therapist, or you can do it with reading books, of course, or listening to podcasts that make you think. Mm-hmm. But it is in our crazy fast-paced life with so much information coming to us about marketing this or this product or this or this or this, we are really not doing a very good job at stopping and thinking about ourselves. I mean, and I really mean thinking about ourselves, not just what we want or what we need to be happier or thinner or this or better or richer, but actually thinking about who we are and how we tick. And if we can carve out more space, more quiet to think about who we are and what makes us tick, I think we would all be that bit more grounded and happy, and the world would be a better place. So that's my one piece of advice, Jess.
That's
How does it
perfect.
Sound?
That is perfect. Thank you so much, Katie. You are a fantastic human being.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
I want to say a massive thank you to our sponsors, Walida. This morning, and this is no word of a lie, I scrubbed my entire body with their birch body scrub. Oh, it smells so good. Trust me on this one. It really does. It's lush. And then, because I was feeling greedy, I followed that with their Wild Rose Cream Body Wash, because I'm obsessed with rose. I have a little fern right in the corner of my shower. And along with the scent, I felt like I could be in one of those, you know, adverts on TV when the forest starts to beautifully grow around you, with colourful birds flying past and butterflies dancing together. It was just I don't know what was wrong with me. I went right off on a tangent. So yeah, if you want to also scrub your beautiful bodies with this lush stuff, visit their website, walida.co.uk. Okay, on with our little cup of happy.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.